Turning now to the book of the prophet Isaiah, chapter 41 and verse 8. Isaiah chapter 41, verse 8. But thou, Israel, art my servant, Jacob, whom I have chosen, the seed of Abraham, my friend. And our subject is God's promises to the future gospel church. This 41st chapter follows a chapter which has been prophecies of power to the gospel church of the New Testament. And the chapter really begins with a prologue about the world in general, the pagan world of Isaiah's time and the atheistic world of our own time. And it's a challenge of God to the world. But I read for a text verse 8, because when you come down to verse 8 of chapter 41, there's a tremendous contrast, and that's what we'll be coming to in a few moments. But I go to the beginning of the chapter, chapter 41, and verse 1, the challenge of God. Keep silence before me, O islands, what is in Isaiah's immediate view in this present vision is the Mediterranean islands, but it's addressed to all people. Keep silence before me, says God. It is a demand, a command to respect and to listen. But the people won't, of course. That's going to be the point of these opening verses. They want nothing to do with the true and living God. They will either make their own substitute gods to their own taste and liking, or, as in more modern times, they'll be atheists and they'll reject the notion of God altogether. But here's the command, which the people won't hear and won't listen to. Keep silence before me and let the people renew their strength. This, we don't readily get the point of this, but this is a kind of permissive statement. Let the people renew their strength. It's like a challenge. Let the people who are against me, says God, who want nothing of me, who want to disbelieve in me, the one true and living God, let them come near. Now, the first come near here refers to come near to each other. Let them confederate. Let them assemble. Let them cooperate together to boost their unbelief or their alternative gods. It's repeated in plainer language in the subsequent verses. Then let them speak. Let them present their case against me. Why they disbelieve. Why they reject me. Let us come near together to judgment, ultimately. So the first verse runs along these lines. Keep silence before me, respect me, but get ready for judgment. Work out your arguments and your excuses. Renew your strength against me. Confer with one another. That is what the world does constantly. That is what we see in our own time. When we see a pandemic such as the present pandemic, and we see the people, the nations, working out how they're going to overcome it, overpower it. There's no thought of God. There's no thought of prayer. But there's a lot of confederating and watching each other. What's this one doing? What's that one doing? And it's the same with arguments against God. It's the same with throwing out the morality of the Bible and bringing in the new alternative morality. It isn't just in this country that you get great movements to change the whole basis of marriage and sexuality, human relationships. It happens all over Europe, all over the world. It's an international thing, and it's always an international movement, and nations comparing notes, preparing their opposition to God and to divine revelation and morality. It's really encapsulated in this verse. Let the people renew their strength. Let them come near together. Then let them speak. And that ultimately they can't prepare adequately for the final reckoning, for the final judgment. Well, let's go on to this prologue, verse 2, very quickly. Who raised up the righteous man from the east? This is undoubtedly a reference to Cyrus, who lies in the future as far as Isaiah is concerned. He ruled from 550 BC to 530 BC, and in the middle of his rule, he overpowered and crushed Babylon, and that was the end of the Babylonian Empire, and his own Persian Empire became supreme. But he was an altogether different ruler, and he started sending nations back to their freedom, and he sent all those Israelites who wished to return to Jerusalem and to their homeland back. But this is writing before this even happened. Who raised up the righteous man from the east? Righteous by comparison with earlier despots and dictators. Called him to his foot, gave the nations before him, made him rule over kings, gave them as dust to his sword and as driven stubble to his bow. And then a feature of his easy conquests in verse 3. Verse 4, who hath wrought it? Who actually superintended all this and permitted it and arranged it and allowed it? Who hath wrought it and done it, calling the generations from the beginning? I, the Lord. So there would be a tremendous upheaval in the world of that time, which was coming. And the children of Israel in captivity would be released to their homeland, and everything geographically would be turned upside down. But it's the Lord who would do it. And then, verse 5, the isles saw it and feared. The ends of the earth were afraid, drew near and came, drew near to each other again, confederated with each other. They helped everyone his neighbor. They went straight to their idols. They consolidated their idols. Here is Israel, being her discipline is over, being released from captivity, being reinstated in Jerusalem and in Judah. And what's our reaction to this? We go back to our gods. We see nothing divine in it. The world is always like that. Great upheavals. It's the hand of God, just as this present pandemic is ultimately a warning from God, the hand of God, without doubt. But what do people do? Well, we see what the leaders of our nation do. We see what our chief men and women in office do and in medical appointments. Do they think of prayer? Do they think of God? Do they think of anything divine? Anything for which they need help or assistance from on high? Oh no. All over the world, confederating together. And you have it here in verse 7. But I want to get to the contrast in verse 8. And it brings us to our second heading. There is a special relationship between God and his people. Whereas the prologue has the world, even if there are great upheavals in the world sent, like war, or the Great Reformation, or something of that kind. It makes little impression on the world. But verse 8, thou Israel, referring to the godly remnant in Israel, in Jerusalem, thou Israel art my servant, the true believers among the Israelites and the coming church of God in the time, the era of Christ. Both are included here. Thou Israel art my servant, Jacob whom I have chosen, the seed of Abraham, my friend. Here are the characteristics of God's people. In the time of Isaiah, those who were not idolaters, those who truly loved him. Of course, in our age, in the gospel age, the time of Christ. Three terms, very quickly, in verse 8, "Thou art my servant." Servants of God. His service comes first. We don't serve money. We don't, I hope, serve ourselves. First and foremost, we serve Christ, who saved us, brought us to himself, whom I have chosen. We never forget that it was by grace alone that we were brought under conviction of sin and a sense of spiritual need and drawn to Christ. It was by grace alone we saw Calvary and the Son of God dying for sinners, and we bent the knee and came to him. It was by his regenerating power in our hearts. The seed, the true descendants, whether Jews or Gentiles who were converted, the seed of Abraham, my friend. That's a wonderful term. It could be translated, but it's an unfortunate word in the way in which it's used today, but it could be translated, my lover. And what it refers to is Abraham, the man who returned my love. I set my love upon him, I saved him, and he returned my love. And on that basis, it was by grace, of course, but on that basis, he receives the illustrious title, my friend. And it's a challenge to us. Are we returning his love in every possible way, as we ought to do? Now to verse 9. This is the relationship which the true believer knows with the Lord. It's our second heading. Thou whom I have taken from the ends of the earth. The Hebrew actually is stronger than taken. I don't criticize the translation. It's perfectly good. Thou whom I have taken. But the Hebrew is something like this. Thou whom I have grasped or clutched. Indicating two things. That it wasn't an easy rescue. We had to be dragged, kicking and screaming almost, from our attachment to this world and love of ourselves and our sin. We had to be drawn, and of course we were very firmly clutched or grasped by the hand of a loving Saviour and drawn to him. And the strength of that grasp still holds us. Thou whom I have taken, grasped, from the ends of the earth. Well, it refers literally to the calling of the Gentiles. First of all, it refers to the captives in Babylon, to whom this great prophecy of Isaiah is initially addressed, that they will be given freedom by Cyrus to return. From the ends of the earth, where the Babylonian Empire had posted them as captives and set them as laborers. But from the ends of the earth, they would be free to return. And that in its time, which literally happened when the Israelites returned, released from the captivity in Babylon, that in its turn was a prophecy of what would happen with the coming of Christ. When the gospel really opened up to the Gentile world and people were rescued from the furthest reaches of the world. Thou whom I have taken from the ends of the earth and called thee from the chief men thereof. And the alternative translation of the Hebrew there is the most remote parts. The Hebrew is something like called thee from the remotest. Our translators have chosen to see it as the chief men, but the remote places is a possible alternative. Either way, and said unto thee, thou art my servant, I have chosen thee and not cast thee away. Now, friends who teach a dispensational view of future things say, oh, this is about the last days when all the Jews are going to return to Christ and be gathered in to the Holy Land. But whatever you think of that, this can't possibly refer to that, because chapter 41 follows chapter 40, which is unmistakably about the gospel church. We know that because it's a time when there will be continued opposition and preaching of the word. Chapter 40 says so. So this chapter 41 is referring to the gospel age too, and the calling out of the Gentiles, not some future event according to our fancy. These are promises to us. And I'm afraid the dispensational view takes them away from us. Verse 11, behold, all they that were incensed against thee, your opponents, the idolaters, and in modern times, the atheistic world, behold, all they that were incensed against thee shall be ashamed and confounded. Ultimately, they'll be disappointed, and their word will be proved wrong. They shall be as nothing. And they that strive with thee, argue with you, shall perish. Thou shalt seek them and shalt not find them. And that's the reasoning. They'll come to nothing, even in your time. But I want to go to a fourth heading from verse 13. And this is about the work of the church, the work of Zion. We could go in some detail through verses 10, 11, and 12, but I come to this 13th and 14th verses. For I, the Lord thy God, will hold thy right hand, saying unto thee, fear not, I will help thee. You'll get a lot of opposition, a lot of unbelief. You'll find yourself working among people who often do not want to hear your testimony. And we pray that hearts will melt and God will prepare them and we shall have opportunity. But generally speaking, there'll be cynicism or hostility. But you have a task to do, and it's going to be to represent him. And this is explained in these verses. I, the Lord thy God, it's him. The emphasis is on the I will help thee. I will help thee. Remember the attributes of God, his invincibility. He is all-powerful. He is faithful. He is all-knowing. He will help us. He cannot fail. I, the Lord thy God, will hold thy right hand. The right hand in Isaiah tends to stand for the hand of decision. The right hand, the source of decision and power. When you're too weak and you don't know what to do, I will hold your right hand, saying, fear not, I will help thee. An absolute promise of God. And verse 14, it's repeated, fear not, thou worm Jacob. Now that's interesting. This very term worm is used in Psalm 22 in a messianic sense. It's referred to Christ. Well, in no way can you describe Christ as a worm. If by worm you mean a synonym for sinner, he was not a sinner. He was spotless and holy. If you mean somebody who is altogether weak and inadequate, he was God. True, he was in a weak body, susceptible to fatigue and to pain and to sorrow, but he was not weak. He had a divine nature as well as a human nature. So in what sense is Christ in the prophecy of Psalm 22 described in terms of a worm? He was held in contempt. Worm refers to what the world thought of him, what the unbelieving world thought, how they assessed him. And that's how the term is used here. Fear not, thou worm, Jacob. And in our age, you Christian, in the estimation of an unbelieving world, you're a worm. You're nothing. You're not respected as far as your faith is concerned. You're strange. You're odd. Yes, that's what they think. But the sense here is, don't you fear, because God is with you, the all-powerful, ever-living God. And ye men of Israel. Now there's bound to be a kind of parallel thought there in the way Isaiah customarily expresses himself. So I think it's quite right, those who interpret it this way. Fear not, thou worm, Jacob, in the eyes of unbelievers, and ye few men of Israel. That's unquestionably the sense. You're surrounded by nations with great armies. There is an empire, now the Persian Empire, in the future. At the time that this letter was addressed to the people, they've gone into captivity. In Babylon, mighty army controls them. There's only a few of them. It's a small nation by comparison. Fear not, worm Jacob, few men of Israel. Doesn't matter. I will help thee, saith the Lord and thy Redeemer, the Holy One of Israel. There's a lot in there. He is the Lord. He is God. In capital letters, the unpronounceable name of God is used. The self-existent, all-powerful God. And thy Redeemer, as Christ, who came to purchase us by suffering and dying for us. So we're purchased. We're his property. We're his. He will not lose sight of us or surrender us up. The Holy One. God's, it's not only that his power is too great to let us go, his integrity is too perfect for him to break his promise to us and let us go down. So everything is put in here by Isaiah. The fact that we are purchased, it's the all-powerful, self-existent God watching over us, and it's the God of absolute integrity. Our natural weakness or limited size or degree of being despised by sophisticated atheism doesn't count at all. And here is the work that we're given. Verse 15. Behold, I will make thee a new sharp threshing instrument, having teeth. Now, obviously, this is a very figurative passage. There are those that insist that everything in prophecy has to be interpreted literally, which, of course, it can't be, because so much prophecy is symbolism. And anybody has to recognize that this is symbolism. People cannot possibly be turned into threshing instruments. So it's the symbols we want to understand. I will make thee, the Jewish Gentile Church of Christ is in mind, the people, the remnant, faithful remnant, who will be released from Babylon in advance of that. I will make thee a new sharp threshing instrument, having teeth to separate the grain from the stalks of the corn crop. Thou shalt thresh the mountains and beat them small, and shalt make the hills as chaff. What's the meaning of the symbol? Well, dear friends, it's obvious. A threshing instrument is an instrument of harvest. the work of the New Testament church will uniquely be to harvest souls, Jews and Gentiles alike, in the one Jewish-Gentile Church of Jesus Christ. And there'll be tremendous difficulty in the task, but because God is with us, it will become possible. I will make thee a threshing instrument, having teeth, or a mouth, says the Hebrew. Thou shalt thresh the mountains. Perhaps Isaiah has in mind the mountains that surround Jerusalem. You will break through them because you're now going out into all the world. And to the Jewish mind, the distant nations were nations of great mountains, and many indeed were. But no difficulty will be too great. You will turn those mountains into dust with your threshing instrument as you preach the word from the granite mountains as hard as flint. Will come souls and converts, and the future judgment of men and their destination in eternity will be to a great degree connected with your work by the power and blessing of God. You will decide through your work, of course you won't decide, God will decide and do the essential work in the heart, but you will have a part in this work that determines whether people are blessed or whether they are judged. This is a promise, supremely and ultimately fulfilled in the New Testament church. Thou shalt thresh the mountains and beat them small, and shalt make the hills as chaff. Now some say, oh, this is all about judgment, but it isn't. It's about the work of the gospel, because it's a threshing instrument. It's a harvest instrument. It separates the grain from the stalks, saved and unsaved. That's our supreme work. Verse 16, thou shalt fan them, and the wind shall carry them away, and the whirlwind shall scatter them. So judgment is going to come from this. The people who reject the gospel will be eternally lost. But overall, it'll be a very happy activity for the people of God. And thou shalt rejoice in the Lord, and shalt glory in the Holy One of Israel. There's nothing which gives Christians greater happiness than to be used of God and to see souls saved. And here's a vital aspect of it as we move to conclusion. Suddenly, Isaiah looks at one aspect of this great work of separating the substance of the mountains. Verse 17, when the poor and needy seek water, and there is none, and their tongue faileth for thirst, I, the Lord, will hear them. I, the God of Israel, will not forsake them. In other words, this is about possibly first the Lord's people, like those who returned from Babylon, long before the coming of Christ. Their discipline was at an end, and now here they are coming back to the Holy Land with nothing. When the poor and needy seek water and there is none, and their tongue faileth for thirst, I, the Lord, will hear them. They're going to be blessed. They're going to be sustained. But it most of all applies, like all these passages, to the future church in the time of the gospel. When the unregenerate sinner, suddenly a work of grace begins in his heart, and he realizes how poor and needy he is, and he doesn't know what to do or where to turn. And maybe he doubles up on his entertainment and the places he'll go to, and perhaps even the sins in which he'll indulge, to shake off this growing feeling that all is not well in life, and he's come to an end to himself, and he wants something greater than this world has, and he comes under conviction of sin and feels his need of forgiveness. He feels guilty. I, the Lord, will hear them, and I, the God of Israel, will not forsake them. It's about the solace of forgiveness and salvation and new life and finding the Lord when we come through that wasteland of conviction and a sense of need. And then conversion. And verse 18, I will open rivers in high places, the dry mountains. Springs will occur and rivers. This is the figure. And fountains in the midst of the valleys, but they're dry deserts. I will make the wilderness a pool and the dry land springs of water. That's a picture of the gospel age. In those high circles where no one wants to talk about God, where no one wants to attribute a pandemic to the overruling sovereignty of God, where no one wants to pray, where no one wants to acknowledge Christ or his church, even in such circles, God will have his witnesses. There'll be a fountain, there'll be a testimony, there'll be a witness. In every conceivable environment in the world, in a country which is Islamic, in the old Soviet Union, desperate to shut out faith, in all kinds of places, free countries, oppressed countries, rich countries, poor countries, there'll be a witness. I will open rivers in high places, and people can be saved, and people are saved everywhere and in all circles. And God will supply those people who are brought to hunger and need and conviction of sin. And the result, our time is up, in verse 19, I will plant in the wilderness the cedar, the shittar tree, and the myrtle and the oil tree, all these trees. The result will be trees. Fruit. The gospel will bear fruit. It'll be strong fruit. Cedars. It'll be productive fruit. The oil tree. It'll be beautiful fruit. Change natures. Change lives. In desperate places and desert places, I will plant my copses of trees. Converted people. Verse 20, we close with this, that they, the unbelieving world, may see and know and consider and understand together that the hand of the Lord hath done this, and the Holy One of Israel hath created it. Dear friends, everywhere there will be a testimony. And you know, there may not seem to be, in this age of unbelief, vast numbers of true Christians and serious Christians. But if you were to look at things a slightly different way, in every circle of people, in every small unit of society, be it a family, a group of friends, a group of colleagues, in a place of education or business or work, in every place where there is a group, however small, of people, there'll be a witness somewhere. There'll be a trophy of grace somewhere that makes everyone think. And they say, how can this be? How can there be such a person? What accounts for him or for her? And his manner and his character and his ways and his words. And God will either use it as a witness to save souls, or he'll use it to judge them. But that's what this passage means. Everywhere there'll be a witness. Well, we've looked at the world generally, we've looked at Zion's relationship with God, we've looked at Zion's special work, we've looked at how people are called out in these recent verses, and Zion's fruit. Let's prove the Lord. May God make us and keep us faithful as his people. Let's close this evening singing the hymn 485. Hymn number 485.